Right, welcome back to the second episode in a new series of the new Rainbow Cast with me, your host, Autistically R. This is a much shorter episode for you today with the content creator and health economist, Tumi Sautier, who is on social media at The Black Dyspraxic, who does some public speaking. He's done, he's written in different publications, consultant on neurodivergency, multiple different work within a neurodivergency activist and advocacy space within the UK on dyspraxia and in exploring intersectionality in the UK neurodivergent space. So hopefully this will be of interest to you. It was great interview, a lot of great insight from Tumi Sautier, and I was quite happy to have him on as guest. He's been somebody who I've been trying to get on for some time, and I'm appreciative of his time, and so I think you will enjoy this. Again, if you want to contact the podcast, it's at New Rainbow Project on social media, on like Instagram, Threads, TikTok, Facebook, and on Blue Sky. Plus also, if you want to email, it's newrainbow@newrainbowproject.com for any questions, suggestions for themes and guests, any comments and feedback on this episode, and if you want to share your own personal experience related to some of the podcast interviews and themes discussed on the podcast, email those that newrainbow@newrainbowproject.com. Or get in touch on social media. You can also ask any questions with the hashtag #AskAutisticallyR on any of the platforms just mentioned. And please also follow those social media channels, as in the past days I've been uploading different content for Autism Acceptance Month and different stuff related to this podcast. You can also find this podcast on YouTube as well as Facebook to watch. There's more details about that on the website at www.newrainbowproject.com, where you can also get the articles, where you can read the podcast interviews and find more information and more articles from the myself doing the New Rainbow Project. And I hope you enjoy this interview. So let's get into it.
Hi, my name is Tumi Sautier. I founded a company called The Black Dyspraxic. In other words, I'm known on the social media as The Black Dyspraxic. I'm all about promoting the intersectionality of race and neurodiversity while creating awareness about dyspraxia globally as well. In my day job, I'm a research assistant in health economics as well. So for me, it's really important to think about data and economics and the impact that that has on people who are neurodivergent. I was diagnosed with dyspraxia at the age of 4. And so dyspraxia has always been a big part of my life. I had challenges growing up. I was always the odd one out, and I realized that there was a lot of stigma even within the black community as well. And so it really started out because I was really having this idea in 2019, and somebody by the name called Remy Ray, she asked me to attend an event in London about neurodiversity and race for Black History Month in 2019, and I attended, and a lot of my friends and family, my loved ones, came to support me to speak. And from there, the Black Dyspraxic was born. And so that started on my Instagram in 2019, and since then I've had a lot of I've just been able to create a lot of content. I've I've had the honor of working with a lot of companies to talk about intersectionality and neurodiversity, specifically in dyspraxia. I've been able to work with organizations to give them advice about how to be more neuroinclusive. I've been able to be a judge on for Genius Within with the Celebrating Neurodiversity Awards. I've contributed on research, done a lot of things. I'm really, really proud of the work that I've done and proud of the growth of the neurodivergent community. So I'm really happy to play a part of that.
Explain about how you got diagnosed and how it affected you from the young age of.
When I was born, the doctors really gave my mom and dad a negative report. They couldn't find my retina. They didn't think I'll be able to hear. They thought I had a lot of challenges. So my mom and dad knew from the from like an early age that I would have some difficulties, but they just didn't know what that was. And there was a lot of misinformation out there. I was born in 1992 and I was diagnosed with dyspraxia at the age of 4. So when we talk about milestones, it took me a long time to walk. It took me a long time to talk. And when I did walk, I would walk quite funny in a way. I had the diagnosis when I was 4, and the doctors recommended that my parents should put me in a sympathetic school. So my mom and dad were able to send me to schools that had a smaller class size, private faith schools, and that meant that I had a lot more attention and supervision that really helped me. Well, things that I struggled with in school were playing sport. I found reading difficult. I hated reading growing up as a kid. My parents would used to try and encourage me to read because they were, we always have the thing about reading is linked to intelligence and reading is how you comprehend stuff. And I struggled with reading. And because of that, my English wasn't that great. I struggled with sentence structure, with literature. My handwriting was a mess. My room was always messy. Because of my dyspraxia, I also struggled with sport, things like basketball, football. And yeah, I wasn't the most competitive guy with sports as well. But one of the things that my parents, that the doctors told my parents was that I had above average intelligence. So my parents encouraged me to, they reaffirmed me that, okay, you might be able to find the spellings wrong and stuff, but you have above average intelligence. So they encouraged me in that way as well. Growing up, I really liked science. I really liked maths because it didn't actually involve that much writing. So that really helped me.
What school was that like a positive experience for you? And did you think that they understood enough about your dyspraxia? And did you find you understood enough about your own dyspraxia in terms of like getting a positive education out of it at that time?
That question is multi-layered. I was fortunate enough that the teachers liked me. I think I got on with the teachers because dyspraxia made me really resilient. I worked incredibly hard. In year 11, I was actually awarded the award for Endeavor from the whole school. So like the most hard working person in school. So there was a lot of support from there. However, growing up, I got a lot of abuse as a child. I was bullied. I'm not sure if I can mention these names, but I was just called the worst of names as a kid, and it had a really big effect on my mental health and my insecurities as well. And then obviously, and especially in my school, sports was a big deal, and I would always mess up. So for example, I would always mess up on the football pitch or mess up doing certain things, and kids were very mean. So that really had a big effect on me. So the teachers liked me, but I didn't have a positive experience with certain children on the playground.
What helped you cope with that, the bullying, and how it impacted your mental health and struggling with certain things like sports and reading? That's something that can knock on your self-esteem and confidence. So what was it of things that helped you through that?
So what really helped me was I'm a Christian. My faith really helped me. My belief in God especially as a teenager, really helped my mental health and really helped me to push through. And my family were very supportive. I had, just a community that believed in me, and that affirmation was really important. But when the bullying was happening, I used to keep a lot of that to myself. And it wasn't until my sister, who was in year 7, came. My sister was 4 years younger than me, so I was in year 11 and she was in year 7. She basically told my parents about how ridiculous the bullying was, because by the time I got to year 11, it wasn't just people in my class that were bullying me, it was just the whole school. And like the name calling, it became part of the culture of the school. As I say, it was quite a small school, so, because it was a private school, so there were 13 people in my year. But when you've got just even if it's four or five people making fun of you and everyone else joining in, it can make you feel like the whole world is against you. And that's what that really, really destroyed my self-esteem.
Yeah, which I can imagine it would impact your self-esteem. So what was then like then after when your sister told your parents about your experiences with bullying and how
So
bad it was?
that only came out because in year 12, I had to leave school because I had a mental breakdown. The bullying was so much, and the work, and this is what it was about, working in a system or in a school that is not conducive to people who are neurodivergent. It caused me to have a mental breakdown. I had to be taken out of school. And at this point in year 12, my parents didn't even know whether I'll go back to school. That really, really, it was at that point, that's when they found out about the bullying and the culture and how I was treated, because everything was just coming out and they just didn't know what to do. So I had to take a step back for 6 months because of my mental health and just retrain. Luckily, by the grace of God, I was able to go to another school. To another sixth form and stuff, but it was tough. It was, and this was around 2009. So mental health was not what it is now. There was a lot of taboos. There was not a lot of support. Do you understand? And another thing that helped me was my mom was a pharmacist. So my mom, being a health professional, she kind of knew what to see and the trigger signs. And we had a lot. I had a lot of friends, I say family members, who were healthcare professionals. So I have an uncle that's a doctor, for example, aunties who were GPs and stuff. So we weren't just relying on the NHS for the support. We had that community that would look out for me, and I've always been thankful for that.
It's something that is to feel fortunate to have that community and support from within your family who were able to help you at the time. And went through a mental health breakdown. And there was with the support of your family that helped you. But what are the things that you help, any other things that helped you throughout the time? And what can help you get through that bad place? And were you able to reach out for any mental health support?
Yeah, so funnily enough, the mental health level support that I got initially, my mom and dad flew me to Nigeria to get support. And this is something that I mentioned in my talks, that my mom and dad flew me to Nigeria to get support because they were so concerned about the inequalities that happens to ethnic minorities in the mental health system, that they didn't want me to get statemented, they didn't want me to get sectioned and everything. So they chose for me to get treated back there. And so a lot of my care and support that I needed for my mental health was done privately. And it wasn't until maybe a few years ago that I actually got my support through via the mental health service.
So what your mother and your family had concerns with the mental health services over here in the UK. And so what were those concerns and what was it like receiving mental health support in Nigeria? Do you think there's particular issues for people of colour receiving mental health support here in the UK?
It should probably be a lot better than it was back then, but and not every I think I'm privileged, so not everybody would be lucky enough to pay for a plane ticket to go somewhere else to get the treatment and the support that you need. That was just a decision that we took. It was a journey, but I think the reason why we were able to make decisions like that was because my mom was a healthcare professional, as I said. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to just anybody, but it's because, for example, she knew that if you go to, like, it was recommend the person that we went to was recommended by one of her colleagues and everything like that, and they made some assessments, and then when we came back, it's like we worked with psychiatrists privately over here as well.
Do you think that if you looked at like the what you know about the Nigeria's mental health support system to like the current mental health services here in the UK, do you think there are some things that maybe Britain could improve upon from the services
I
that you
think one of the
may
things
refer?
that Britain one of the things that Britain could is just the cultural nuances. So somebody that is loud, or for example, the Nigerian culture is a typically a loud and expressive culture, and someone being sometimes I speak quite loudly and I don't know when to talk quietly or to talk succinctly, and those cultural nuances. Sometimes you can may see someone say, "Oh, this person's just being very erratic," and it's like, no, that's how someone speaks normally. And just those biases as well is just something that needs to be dealt with.
For just was more inclusive like system to come across. And so do you want to also explain what it was like how also religion played in when to helping you for your mental health, like how like find Christianity and stuff like that. So did you find stuff like that helped with, you know,
Yes, definitely. Praying, worshipping. A lot of my friends, even to this day, the majority of my community is Christian community. So I have this mantra when I deal with mental health or with anything that I'm struggling with, because my background, I'm also a medical science graduate as well. So I deal with the medical aspect and I deal with the psychological aspect, but I also know that all these things have spiritual implications as well. So I try to do my best to make sure that I, when I'm dealing and I'm going through issues, I'm dealing with all these different aspects of me, because all these different aspects of me make me who I am. And so for me, that means that when I'm going through issues or going through trials, I'm definitely getting a multidisciplinary, holistic approach. Which I'm really, really thankful for. I think it makes me a more balanced person.
Do you want to also explain more about what it was like then when you went back into the school system then after your like mental health breakdown and when you found to be more able to get out of
Yeah.
that
So,
space?
yeah, so I think I wasn't, I was after that mental health challenge that I realized that. I think I became more aware or more accepting of dyspraxia and the impact that dyspraxia had on my life. So it was that at that age that I took a bit more initiative. I joined the Dyspraxic Foundation. I found out the people that were like that were neurodivergent like me. Do you understand? I built those relationships, but especially for those years, there was a lot of people who were dyspraxic. That even though they had similar neurotypes to me, they weren't necessarily from, we didn't have the same background. Going to sixth form, I was able to get another diagnosis, which was private through dyspraxia, and that diagnosis was able to make recommendations to my school in terms of what accommodations and everything that I would need. At A level, I studied biology, chemistry, economics, and maths, so quite difficult and academically challenging topics, and so the support that I needed was really important to me. That was challenging. So when I was in sixth form, I was a year behind everyone else. So everybody in my year was older than me, was younger than me by a year. We just take things day by day and everything. Then I went to university, but before even university happened, I was able to apply for disability student allowance to get the support that I needed for my workplace as well. So it's been really helpful.
When you've got a college to university student, what were the things about the streets of destruction that affected you? What are the kind of things you experienced with it? And what are the things then that helped you and the reasonable adjustments you could get when you applied for DSA?
So the things that affect me, reading large volumes of text at once, organizing, having revision notes, but organizing everything in the system. I would write notes and they'll get messy or they get lost, they get misplaced. I put a lot of pressure on myself, self-esteem and confidence, all these things. Even things like tying shoelaces, for example, or making sure that my environments were as clean as possible. These things I've always struggled with. And so DSA was able to have, I was able to get assistive technology. Some of them were better than others. So, for example, I had DSA at 2011. I was able to have Dragon, which was an assistive technology software that allowed me to speak into the, and it would type out for me. In theory, it's a very good piece of technology, very, very good piece of tech, but it never worked for me. It took me a lot of time for training. As someone who was a student, you don't really have that time to really want to train those th to train those things. The assistive technology is definitely getting better. I was at the dyslexic show the other day, and there was one company that's doing amazing text-to-speech stuff in the space. So it's definitely getting better, but it really wasn't what it was. Well, it could be a decade ago. But I felt like that support was helpful because that support allowed me to have a good academic career in university, but it also made sure that I had extracurricular activities in university, and it made sure that university was an incredible experience for me. I loved my university experience.
So what are things that made you have enjoy that university experience? And what were the positive things that you
So
really took out of it?
one of the positives was just I just came into my own. I discovered my strength. I discovered that I wasn't for so for example in my course, in my on my year in my course, there were other dyspraxic people. There were other people that had dyspraxia, which was amazing, and we were able to relate with each other and learn from each other. I was able to get involved in extracurricular activities. So in my second year, I was president of the African Caribbean Society, and then president of Christian society called NUMA in my fourth year. What that meant was I developed leadership skills, and I realized that me being dyspraxic meant that there were certain skills such as being a visionary, being an ideas person, being a team worker in interpersonal skills, that became very natural to me. I realized that, oh, this skill of having great social skills and a good people person was a unique skill that not everybody had. And so my time at Exeter made me gave allowed me to get strength that I were I that was that were resonated with me, which was great.
Being able to have the chance where you could find your community and, explore certain areas of your identity. So what was it like finding that community that you weren't exposed to many, I assume you weren't exposed to when you were in school?
So it wasn't like I didn't have the African Caribbean community in school. I think what happened was when in university was I became, what happened was I was beginning to discover myself, who I was, becoming more confident with me, with what I can do, what I can't do, realizing that socially I could be a person that can contribute, someone that could make a difference to not just my life, but community of others around me. And it was a really, really good time. Someone like literally some of the like some like even some of the people I was speaking to now today are people from university. And that was and university was over 12 years ago. You know, I graduated, I started school in 2011. And so some of these people, university will literally really change how I saw myself.
Into research on data health. So, what was inspiration about studying that and getting involved in that as your job?
Initially, I wanted to do medicine. I think it's a standard thing that every Nigerian that is good at math and science, you would at least think about it. And I know when I was younger, people used to tell me, you have really bad dexterity and coordination. How could you be a doctor? And I really wanted to prove people wrong. But in sixth form, I also loved economics. I really liked economics. I loved thinking about the bigger picture. I loved thinking about the bigger picture, society, how everything worked. And I loved the field of economics, understanding how markets work, understanding how to allocate things more efficiently. And so, for example, there was two things I even wanted to do, go into medicine or finance. So when I applied, I actually applied to go to medicine, but I didn't. I got the offer, but I didn't get the grade. And the plan was to do medical science and then do medicine afterwards. But I didn't like medicine enough to want to do that. I wasn't inspired by medicine enough to do that. But I came across a topic called health economics, which was a good blend of the medical science and the social science, and I think it really brought it together for me, and that's why I chose to do that.
Coming from a medical family, pharmaceutical family, I guess that's where that interest of pursuing that as a career kind of came. You're more interested in economics and the financial side of things. So,
Yeah.
where does that interest?
I've always been quite analytical and interested in finance and interested in why people act the way they, why do people behave the way people behave. And I remember even just hearing, I grew up with people that understood economics. Growing up, my parents ran businesses. So hearing concepts like economies of scale and things like that, I just was really interested in that. And also because I'm quite analytical and strategic, economics looked like a good fit. What I do now as a health economist is that I work at the university, Newcastle University, and I look at how interventions, like be it drugs or surgical interventions or vaccines, could be as cost effective. So I do economic evaluations to assess whether these interventions are going to be value for money for the NH. So there's a process of how we calculate that, which is very methodical, a lot of detail. And that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. I've been doing that for 4 years now.
Going back to your back to dyspraxic, and you know, you do events in terms of like public speaking. So, do you want to explain a lot more about that part of your that job of what you do as
Yes.
that
So
as well?
I do public speaking. I talk a lot about dyspraxia, what dyspraxia is, and talking about how there's a lot of people that talk about ADHD, autism, dyslexia, but dyspraxia is something that is also something that we need to talk about. And like the ADHD and autism, dyspraxia also has its strengths, but it also has its challenges. Dyspraxia is another word for dyspraxia. That is more the medical agreed term, is developmental coordination disorder. So we know that dyspraxia is to do with challenges with coordination, voice and fine motor skills, etc. What I then do is, because of the Black dyspraxic, I like to talk about the intersectionality and why intersectionality is important, to make people realize that yes, it's important that we talk about disability and neurodivergence, but we need to recognize that people from different minorities have compounding forms of discrimination, compounding forms of hardship, and it's very nuanced. So the experience of someone that is the experience of a woman who has dyspraxia may be very different from a man that has dyspraxia, or for somebody that or the experience of someone that lives in the northeast of England may be very different from someone that lives in southwest London, for example, because there's so many things that contribute to our identity and make us who we are. So I go and talk to organizations about why that is important and what we need to think about. I just give them challenges and I give them advice of how they can be more neuro inclusive, so more inclusive of different neurotypes, but understanding that intersectionality is an important factor as well.
I know myself that intersectionality is so important for the community, something that needs to be off the forefront of activism within the disabled and neurodivergent
Yeah.
community. And with you saying that about that, do you want to explain? I know the importance of it, but do you want to explain the importance of intersection within the neurodivergent community and what it looks like and what are the type of things that you kind of hone in and focus about when you're doing public speaking on intersectionality within the neurodivergent community?
Before we even talk about why intersectionality is important, it's very important for us to describe what intersectionality is and why it started in the first place. So, intersectionality was a term coined by Kimberlé Crenshaw that understood that her experiences as a black woman was very different from her exp from the experiences of black men and white women. So her experience of racism and feminism was unique because she was a black woman, and she just coined the term intersectionality. And so when we think about the intersection, two identities intersecting, overlapping each other, and so she brought the idea of that these forms of discrimination and marginalization overlap through each other to make a unique experience. And when we think about forms of discrimination and oppression and these challenges, we have to understand people from minority and marginalized backgrounds can have overlapping marginalizations, and that's really important. And so because of that, we need to understand that the term intersectionality is important to ensure that nobody gets left behind. Because if we don't have an intersectionality and an intersectional approach, what could happen and what used to happen is we talk about autism and we talk about ADHD, but we just think about white middle class men, and that's it. Without thinking about the women, without thinking about ethnic minorities, without thinking about working class people, without thinking about the LGBT community, you understand? Without thinking about different religions. So, but we understand that humanity is complex. So, intersectionality ensures that we have a framework that ensures that nobody gets left behind.
Yeah, and it's quite important that because, like, I suppose when you do pub, then interacted with people within the neurodivergent community, and I know it's something that, it can be the case that even still, say, whether you're like a black or any like woman of, person of color, and from minority genders and all that. That he can be quite receive more barriers to being recognized as being neurodivergent and actually get diagnosed and recognized with those conditions. And I think, yeah,
Exactly.
and it's something that I guess you feel all too familiar with, and because that's perceived failure. And what are the things that you find are like stigmatized and stereotyped around the intersection within the dyspraxic and neurodivergent community? What are the things that people need to be aware of, how it can present like?
Really good question. So, for example, with the intersection, I think one thing I need to say is that for everybody, it's a bit different. For example, one of the things that I always say is that as a black guy, rhythm and coordination, as a black person, you're supposed to be good at people, society would say sport or music and rhythm and all these type of things. You know, growing up, those were the type of black role models that you have. But distraction meant that put a spanner into all of those works. I did not follow those society norms. You know, distraction meant that it was my mind that was my greatest strength. It was the thing that I learned to, you know, and it challenges that notion that no, why can't black people be academic? Why can't we contribute to papers? Why can't we be thought leaders in a different way? And so, yeah, that was one of the big differences.
Yeah, that definitely can be quite like a way of like people being, I guess, misunderstood, or, you know, like with, I guess, expectations of like being expected to have certain skill sets. And but what are the key things have you like talked about within your speeches and public speeches on dyspraxia, and even like speaking to organizations and companies? What the things are that you tend to look to bring across?
So I tend to think about some of the difficulties, but some of the unique strengths. To be honest, with all the questions that you've asked me, we've touched on different aspects of some of my talks. Because I do talk about my lived experience. I talk about the challenges that I had, the difficulties that I had in bullying and stuff, but how the fact that we need to be more neuro-inclusive. Some of the things that I also try to do is to make people think about how inclusion is not just allowing someone to do access to work, but thinking about universal design. What does that look like? What can we change about our systems to really make sure that we're being more acceptable for everybody?
What are things I would recommend for like maybe consult with organizations or companies if that is a party role? What are the terms of things like when you mentioned universal design and making that new inclusive environment? What are the things would you recommend to organizations, companies, and like places of education? What are things
So,
that
if hybrid working, for example, number one, number two, if you're applying for a job, it doesn't necessarily have to be things like sending a CV and a cover letter. Why can't I present a video or an audio of explaining the qualities? You know, just asking people, okay, what support do you need? When people disclose to you about these are my challenges, this is my neurodivergent, instead of asking what are your challenges, why don't we start by asking what are your strengths? Asking people how can you include, how can we be more inclusive? What benefit can we make? These questions are really important. There's tons of work and there are people doing amazing stuff, but yeah, these are just a few things we can do.
within your current job you have, do you feel that you got enough adjustments, and do you think that is a new inclusive
Yes,
environment, and what
yes.
the
So one of the things that I do is I have resource ERGs, so resource groups that I work with that get, and then also I've been able to use access to work. So access to work is a system where I can get support from the government. I've been helped with coaching and stuff, and it's been really good supportive. But I do need to. I'm in the process of getting more help as well, to see what other help I can get.
Black Dyspraxic social media account, your advocacy with your intersectionality. What do you find are the key issues facing Black neurodivergent people?
I think the main thing is that for a long time, our voices weren't recognized. People didn't really talk about, okay, the fact that, you know, this was unique to the, that there were different experiences in different communities, number one. Number two, you need to understand that there's still high levels of stigma within the black community about disabilities and stuff that may be different from other communities. So that means that there's a lot of ableism and things like that that we're still challenging within our own communities as well. But it's one of those things where our voices weren't recognized in literature, in the evidence space, and we're definitely changing that. So it's really good to see.
What do you find are the examples of you seeing that things changed, and you know, the things that keep you hopeful in terms of like seeing that difference in representation. Do you
Yes.
think that representation out there is good enough, and what are the things would you like to see changed, improved
It's
representation?
definitely not good enough, but there's definitely improvements. I'm seeing a lot of people, black neurodivergent people writing books. One of my good friends, Martha, wrote a book about black brilliant dyslexic, and it had a lot of black dyslexic individuals writing their own stories. There's another book called Autistic and Black, and that's really the same about autistic people writing their own stories, black autistic people writing their own stories as well. And so that is definitely increasing. I think what I would like to see, and it's definitely what I want to see as a researcher, is that now the black community become more involved in research and and building that evidence base, which is really important.
Yeah, I think, yeah, as you said, that is really important because, like, as touched on earlier, that, within the black neurodivergent community, there's often a, like, a lot lack of diagnosis, and,
Yes.
like, a lot lack of people within the black neurodivergent community who feel kind of satisfied or understood what they need, and, like, feel that they have positive experience within society, whether that's for the workplace, schools, like seeking medical support. As you say,
Exactly.
that, part of that, you would want to see that more confidence when you, like, seeking out for mental health, as you would want to make sure that anybody would, like, as would have a bit more confidence in the NHS and within the UK health system, and for you, like your parent not having to think about, like, that the British health services weren't maybe as accessible for a black person who was suffering mental health stuff. Yeah, if you get what I mean. You listed some of the books for people to read. Are there any other resources you would recommend?
Yeah, follow me on the Black Dyspraxic, but also check out the Diverse Creative Homecoming Project. That was a research paper that I did for the Diverse Creative that was about the experiences of black individuals in Lambeth. There's loads of books. For example, Onyinye did a book, Dyslexia and Me. There's the ADHD Babes. There's a load of organizations that are doing incredible work in the space. And so, yeah, we're just growing every day, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
From what you see on social media, you do quite a lot within that, because you chatted to Forbes, you've done a lot of different interviews for since you, like, started your advocacy work from the last 5 years. And so when you've been able to chat to economics magazines such as Forbes and to different media sources, what has that experience been like chatting within the media about such issues?
It's been good. I had an article in Forbes, which is incredible. But it's not just about the publications. It's about creating awareness. It's about
Yeah.
understanding, okay, the metrics are good, but are we making impact? Are we influencing? Are we changing? Are we changing what needs to be changed? So I'm happy with the work that I've done, but there's so much more that needs to be done.
What things would you like to see improved within society for people, and what are the things that you would like ideally change and improve for neurodivergent people for the better?
I think we just need more funding in our services. We need now we know we have a bit more awareness, and it's good that we're doing awareness, but now what? What do we do next? What needs to happen next? How do we challenge it? How can we do better? And so those are the type of things that just needs to happen. And we're getting there, but it's gonna take a push.
What would you like to see funding go into, and what action do you want to see?
So funding in terms of research, in terms of better policies, I think we should get to this point where everybody at a certain age should be screened for their neurotype. So whether you're dyslexic or you have ADHD, everything, like as by the time before people go to secondary school, Everybody should be doing that. And then we need to also have more funding for a lot of people say, oh, the educational system, the university system, and it's falling to pieces. It's the reason why there is, or the NHS, is because of lack of funding. So, and I know there's cost of living crisis, but we really need to change the way we fund our public services. Government definitely needs to do more. And I know I'm an economist, so there might be an interesting way of how we tax certain individuals more than others, because we've had so much levels with austerity. What's happened? The issue is with all the increased awareness of neurodiversity, which has been great, at the same time, the government has cut funding in line with inflation. That's detrimental. We now have a lot of people understanding that they have differences, but the trouble is they don't know where to go for that support.
Yeah, that's interesting. Right, no, I'll say that. I think because support, like, there's so many backlogs within the NHS, so many with like getting diagnosed for any neurodivergent condition, especially like if you look at something like ADHD or whatever, that can take like months and years on waiting lists. And you know, it's like recently there's been reported medications or shortages for conditions like ADHD. And I guess something they might find with the cost of living crisis, government and, you know, maybe, and within politics, those deciding more that money is supposed to be spent. There has been something with the cost of living crisis where they could use it as like a get out of jail card on terms of like get investing more money into services, you know, with trying to get away with this idea that there's not enough money in the pot because of like an increase of buying more things, you know, like the increased cost of things for the government to spend on us. But as you said, that there needs to be something that people can be able to see things done for the better and see actual action, because it is definitely good about talking about these things. And chat sessions like Dyspraxia Foundation and anything like your advocacy work does to actually improve things, but for actually there to be real services for people.
Yeah, exactly. We just need more services.
Your work with the Dyspraxia Foundation, what stuff have you been able to do with that?
So, for example, with the dyspraxia, I used to be part of Dyspraxia Youth. I think they're an incredible charity and they've done incredible work to increase awareness for dyspraxia. And last year I was able to speak at quite a few of their events. And so yeah, they're doing great work. And so anybody that wants to know more about dyspraxia should definitely check out their website.
Thank
Really good
you.
organization, really lovely people. They're doing, yeah, it's an example of a small charity with an ambitious heart. They have a helpline, they do events, they have newsletters, and it's a really good hub for anybody that just wants to find out a bit more about the structure.
Thanks again for tuning me so today for coming on this week's podcast. Again, if you're in contact the podcast, it's at New Rainbow Project on social media and a New Rainbow at New Rainbow Project via email. Please do get in touch if you have any feedback from this interview and some of your own experiences and thoughts related to this interview, as well as any ideas for future episodes and future guests that you would like to feature on this podcast. And any general questions from myself that I can answer on this podcast, use that hashtag or in topic thread of Ask Autistically R. And just a reminder of what's coming up for you and for next week. Next week I'll be interviewing Bex Folsom. Bex Folsom is non-binary, and we'll be chatting about the experience about not being non-binary and identifying as queer within a neurodivergent community. They are multiply neurodivergent with conditions like autism, ADHD, dyspraxia. We'll be chatting about that and the hobby of sailing. And also about the membership of the Liberal Democrats and how they got involved in politics. And as I will highlight in that interview, myself, I am a member of the same political party here in the UK, and I have interests of keeping that balance. And also, please do get in touch if you are a member of another political party within the UK or have in any interest in politics at all within the United Kingdom, and you fall into the category of being disabled, neurodivergent. As within this election year within the United Kingdom, I look to cover a lot more of what it means to be a neurodivergent and disabled within politics, and looking at the politics and the policies that affect neurodivergent people, trying to create conversations around what needs to be done for neurodivergent and disabled people within society. As I like to try to focus on giving engaging and interesting interviews and conversations around what can make society better for neurodivergent and autistic people. Also, please do feel free to contact the podcast if you want to get on, if you're from another country, and do some and talk about what things are like within your country as a neurodivergent person, or if there's any other ideas and themes you would like me to discuss from different countries, please do get on the podcast and find on that social media handle at Rainbow Project, or email neurorainbow@neurorainbowproject.com. And with that, looking into the end of the podcast this week, and as I say, if you want to get more on social media, I'll be giving more posts about autism acceptance month, and hopefully within the next week I'll have also work on getting a special for autism acceptance month up, where we'll look back at some of the interviews you had about autism with autistic people and highlights of some of the things I've discussed on social media about my experience of being autistic and my reflections of what autism is in a more of a diary episode and highlights. So do keep an eye out for that. So thank you for listening to this week's podcast, hosted by me, Autistically Avid guest, Timothy Sautier, and this is for the New Rainbow Project, singing out for another week. Thank you. Goodbye.